Today, The Deluded, the DFA Daily for the 23rd of April 2020. Hello again, I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Welcome to our latest finance and problem news with a distinctively Australian flavour. There's more evidence today of just how serious the economic crosswinds are. Challenger recorded an 8% drop in assets under management during the March quarter, with the group's chief citing a volatile market and ramped up redemptions from super funds. The group ended the third quarter of the financial year on $79 billion in total assets under management, with its funds management business copping $2.3 billion in net outflows during the period. Funds under management was $74.8 billion, down by $8.1 billion or 10%. During the quarter, Managing Director and Chief Executive Richard Howes said Challenger's performance during the quarter reflected the impact of the virus was having on both investment markets and consumer activity. The drop in assets under management includes the effect of major market movements in the period, as well as some redemption in funds management as superannuation funds seek liquidity to fund members switching to cash and withdrawing funds, Mr. Howes said. And Mr. Howes reported disruption in the financial advice industry in the mix with the pandemic dampening annuity sales. There's no doubt that the challenges financial advisors are already facing following the Royal Commission have been further exacerbated by the pandemic, which has impacted their ability to onboard new clients and engage effectively with their existing customers. Understandably, many are focused on responding to immediate client needs at this time, as rules around superannuation are changed to address the current situation. But while the current environment highlights the value of annuities in providing secure income in retirement, he commented that the confluence of disrupted events is expected to continue to impact sales in the near term, with the revenue in the fourth quarter remaining uncertain. And Treasurer Josh Frydenberg has revealed that the number of Australians who've accessed their superannuation under the government's early release scheme is 456,000 Australians. And that totals around $3.8 billion in claims. The average withdrawal was $8,000. The super funds now have 5 days to process the claims. And the ATO has also paid out $3 billion to 177,000 businesses as part of the government's cash flow boost measures, while 275,000 businesses have filled in application forms for JobKeeper. Around half of those are sole traders. And Matthew Ross of Goldman Sachs estimates that up to $44 billion could be withdrawn from superannuation funds by people who've been financially hit by the pandemic, and that is based on 10% of superannuation members withdrawing $20,000 of funds. Ross's estimates compares to the federal government's forecast withdrawals of $27 billion and the superannuation industry's estimates of between $50 and $60 billion. And Ross contends that the early access scheme could result in liquidity issues for some super funds, which could in turn be forced to reduce their exposures to shares. In turn, this could place downward pressure on share prices and reduce the benchmark S&P ASX 200 market's capitalization by around just 0.45%. And tax specialists are reporting an exponential increase in the number of cash-strapped landlords seeking tax deductions amid falling rents from tenants, according to the AFR. The rate of inquiries from property investors in April has been increasing exponentially from the lows of late March, said Noel Petrohelius, a director of BMT Tax Depreciation, which specialises in tax depreciation for residential and commercial property. I expect July will be a bumper period for taxpayers lodging early to get their hands on bigger than usual refunds, says Mark Chapman, Director of Tax Communications for H&R Block. And also from the AFR, retail rents could fall as much as 30% over the next 2 years, driving down property values as the pandemic shutdown accelerates the decline of the once dominant sector. The devastation across retail will expedite a wide-ranging reset of rents and assets that was already underway as the sector negotiates the challenges of e-commerce and softening sentiment, according to analysts. The current situation de-accelerates the derating of miles in line with their offshore peers, but also accelerates the rebasing of rents, Jefferies analyst Shiloto Makonoki told the Australian Financial Review. And Meriton's Harry Trigonoff says apartment rents have fallen 10% simply because people can't pay. Universities are set to suffer significant enrolment and staff reductions as overseas students decline, and overseas tourism has stopped and labour-intensive bars and restaurants are closed. Many will never open under present owners. People with negatively geared property are being minced because tenants will not or cannot pay rent and are being protected by new landlord and tenant rules. Those that took out mortgages based in two incomes often now have only one and fear for the second. Soon they will see the values of their dwellings fall. And Victorian Treasurer Jim Pallas says Victoria's fall will be 10% by December, so that becomes a national benchmark. In many areas, it'll be even more severe. Or to put it another way, we have a glut of goods and services and we're headed for falling prices. In Australia, we assume inflation is part of the game. It's likely to fall to token levels and may even be in negative for some months. Our community borrowed to the hilt to buy houses. In an era of no inflation and sometimes deflation, that becomes a huge burden. And now there are predictions that in the short term, Australia's population will fall and not rise, as was assumed. And the Prime Minister has called on banks to step up to the mark and reduce the lags in processing and offering bridging finance for businesses. Speaking during a press conference today, Scott Morrison provided an update on the JobSeeker and JobKeeper packages, outlining that 587,686 JobSeeker applications have been received so far. More than we do in a year, he said. However, Mr. Morrison noted that while these economic packages have been released to help businesses and employees survive the pandemic, he called on the banks to step up too. The Prime Minister said, for these arrangements to work, we need the continued strong cooperation from the banking sector and for the superannuation sector. I am aware that there has been some frustration amongst some businesses in particular in accessing bridging finance with banks. We are aware of that. I have no doubt that banks are aware of that, and we need to be addressing that early on in this crisis. The bank's decision to pass on the cash rate reductions and to provide waivers of various arrangements for businesses and individuals is very much welcome, and it's to be continued, he says. It's important the banks step up to the mark here. Indeed, Morrison said he was concerned in the increasing number of stories we're getting regarding this access to bridging finance and the times taken to process applications. We need those turnaround times to improve, he said, noting that many banks will already know the small business customers applying for the finance, suggesting that processing should be taking less time than it is. These banks know those businesses, so they know their history, they know their trading performance, they know what they're capable of doing, he added. They have to stand by these businesses in their time of greatest need, and that is now. And the ABS released preliminary estimates for Australian international merchandise trade for the month of March 2020, which is designed to help to measure the economic impact of the virus. These estimates are compiled from administrative data like customs records, sourced from the Department of Home Affairs, and are subject to revision. These preliminary estimates are presented on the original basis, current prices, not on a basis used in the balance of payments. This means that the data is presented on a customs basis, whereas other data is derived from the customs basis by applying adjustments for factors such as valuation, coverage, timing, and residence, as required by the balance of payments and international investment manual. Exports of goods in March 2020 increased from the revised February 2020 figure of 28 billion by 8 billion or 29% to 36.1 billion. The large increase in exports comes after declines in January and February. The increase in March was predominantly driven by a 4.5 billion or 20% increase in the value of exports of non-rural goods and a 2.4 billion or 225% increase in the value of exports of non-monetary gold. Within non-rural goods, there were increases in exports from the resources sector, including strong increases in the value of exports of coal, gas, and petroleum, and in particular, a large increase in the value of exports of iron ore to China. The increase in the value of non-monetary gold was driven by exports to Hong Kong and the United Kingdom. Year on year, exports in March 2020 increased by 4.8 billion or 16% on March 2019. And on the import side, goods increased from the revised February 2020 figure of 21.9 billion by 2.06 billion or 10% to $23.7 billion. This increase was driven by increases in capital goods up 895 million or 18%, intermediate and other goods up 583 million or 6%, and non-monetary gold up 467 million or 85%. The increase in imports was spread across a range of goods. Within capital goods, there were large increases in the importing of mobile phones, office and machinery, including laptop computers and aircraft. China is Australia's largest source of imports, accounting for, on average, around a quarter of the value of all imports. But imports from China declined significantly in February, with a 41% decline on the January month. In March, imports from China regained some strength, up $300 million or 7%. Driving this increase were increases in imports of consumer electronics, such as mobile phones and laptop computers, as well as electrical machinery. And year-on-year, imports in March 2020 decreased by $262 million, or 1%. Taking this into account, and the big retail numbers yesterday, there's just a chance that we might, in the March quarter, dodge a GDP fall, and so we'll have just one massive hit in the June quarter, so technically avoiding a recession. Now, that would show once again that we are perhaps still the lucky country, but we'll see. Meantime, CBA's flash composite PMI pointed to a much stronger contraction of the Australian private sector during April, with the decline particularly severe in the services sector. The virus led new orders to fall at a steep pace, with employment scaled back markedly as a result. Both input costs and output prices decreased, but this was reflective of trends in the services sector as manufacturing inflation trends actually accelerated. The headline figure derived from the survey is the Commonwealth Bank of Australia's Flash Output Index, which is designed to provide timely indications of changes in output in the Australian private sector. Readings above 50 signal improvement in business activity on the previous month, while readings below 50 show deterioration. The index is a GDP-weighted average of the Commonwealth Bank Flash Manufacturing Output Index and the Commonwealth Bank Flash Services Business Activity Index. And flash indices are based on around 85% of final survey responses. The services index moved from 38.5 in March to 19.6 in April, while the manufacturing PMI slid from 49.7 in March to 45.2 in April. And Gareth Aird, CBA's head of economics, said the services sector has been hit a lot harder than the manufacturing sector, and the pace of job shedding is concerning, though not surprising, given the large number of Australian businesses that remain shut. The extent to which the PMI will rebound will be dictated in large part by the duration of the enforced shutdown. And the calls for major economic reforms to drive growth are growing, and the talk of company tax cuts are back. But many are calling for the property market to be stoked yet again. Australians who buy a house or employ people could be scared having to pay hated taxes as part of a plan to kickstart the economy after the virus. Economists regard the state taxes as a killer to growth and employment, with the virus threatening to cause the steepest downturn since the 1930s Great Depression. In Sydney, someone buying a typical house to live in has to pay more than $41,400 upfront in stamp duty if they aren't a first home buyer. That's in a city where the median price stands at more than $1.02 million, according to CoreLogic. Business owners in New South Wales also have to pay a 5.45% payroll tax for every person they employ if they have a turnover of more than $900,000. and that threshold is increasing to $1 million from July 2021. The government of Australia's most populous state, however, is open to scrapping those taxes to stimulate the economy as unemployment rises and possibly replacing them with land or state income taxes. New South Wales' Dominic Perrott said he wanted to, quote, retool and rebuild our economy after the virus with new policies. It's very clear business as usual is not an option, he told the Daily Mail. Victoria's Labor Treasurer Tim Pallas also wants federal help to get rid of inefficient state taxes as virus restrictions are lifted later this year. We are keen to work with the Commonwealth, he told reporters on Wednesday. We'll have to reassess the way that the burden of taxation and the recovery effort falls within the economy, because there will be some sections of the economy that are quite profoundly and adversely and in the long term badly affected by the changes. And the New South Wales Treasury Review of Federal Financial Relations, headed by former Telstra boss David Thodey, has suggested replacing these, quote, unfair taxes with possible help from the Commonwealth government to make this happen. The state taxes that receive the most mentions across submissions and consultations were transfer duty or stamp duty, payroll tax, and insurance-based taxes, it said. Economists regard the state taxes as a killer to growth and employment, with the virus threatening to cause the steepest downturn since the 1930s Great Depression. More than half of all submissions raised transfer duty, with the majority of people calling for the tax to be replaced, while others suggested the tax rate be reduced or thresholds increased. And the Committee for Sydney told the inquiry stamp duty was a major financial disincentive for retirees seeking to downsize. And the Property Council of Australia said it made housing even more unaffordable for young people. Stamp duty distorts business decisions, locks families out of housing choices, worsens housing affordability, suppresses economic activity, and leaves governments with highly volatile revenue streams, they told the review. It is a tax that is a relic from a colonial past, representing a stamp of the state's authority over property transactions. There's absolutely no economic relevance in our modern Australia. And stamp duty is a major cash cow for the state government, raising an estimated $8.3 billion from the transfer duty in the year 2019-20 financial year. And budget papers predict this revenue stream will continue to grow by 1.5% per annum until 2022, when the tax would raise $9.2 billion annually. Alternatively, why not let interest-only loans rip, according to the Liberal Party's whip, Dean Smith, who has called for property investor mortgages to be converted to interest-only mortgages to increase disposable income and prevent the property market from falling into a tailspin. Smith said up to 730,000 interest-only loans expire this year and are due to be converted to principal interest. That means those borrowers will have to individually divert thousands of dollars from their disposable income into making principal repayments. At the same time, the hundreds of thousands of investors who have been forced into converting their interest-only loans into principal interest loans over the past few years are also individually paying thousands of dollars in principal repayments. A finance expert with financial services monitoring firm Canstar, Steve Mickenberger, said the proposal was a no-brainer. He said if interest and principal loans were converted to interest only, many investors would see their monthly repayments halved. And I need to underscore, you still have an obligation to repay the capital at some point. And of course, earlier, ASIC warned of just this problem. So I think we need to be very cautious. And I am concerned of all the voices corralling around the property market to try and support prices again. Haven't we learnt our lesson yet about too much debt and too high house prices chasing each other? And finally, back to the contact tracing phone app. Essential Research published research to say that only 38% of households said they would download this app onto their mobile phone, and only 35% were confident the government would not misuse the data. More than 6 in 10, or 63%, say would be concerned about the security of their personal data if the app was on their phone. And 52% agreed the app would help limit the spread of the virus, and 42% would speed up the removal of physical distancing restrictions. But Stefan Volk, Associate Professor and Co-Director at Body, Heart and Mind in Business Research Group at the University of Sydney, wrote in The Conversation, as governments look to ease general social distancing measures and instead use more targeted strategies to stop the virus transmission, we face a social dilemma about the limits of cooperative behaviour. Oxford University research suggests such apps could help to control the epidemic if 60% of the population use them. Though even lower uptake, they would still get some benefit. The government's goal is for 40% of the population to use the app. It's hoped people will do this voluntarily. Now that's double the uptake so far achieved in Singapore, which launched its Trace Together app on March the 20th. This despite a Six Nations survey, including Australia, suggesting Singaporeans are more relaxed about personal privacy concerns. Volt's research into corporate behaviour suggests there is no reason to believe voluntary uptake will be higher anywhere else. And he talks of a social dilemma. So there's a couple of observations. First, the majority of us must be reassured that others are doing the right thing. This involves showcasing cooperation and granting no preferential treatment of any kind. And second, we must be assured others are not getting away with uncooperative behaviour. In other words, free riding must be swiftly and visibly punished. Or in other words, it sounds to me as though there are going to be some interesting shenanigans if this app is foisted on us, and it may not be that effective even if it is. So standing back, it looks as though the economy is continuing to deteriorate and more factors are in play and more people in the community are being hit. And yet, until such time as the virus is under control, it seems impossible to start opening the taps and getting the economy to come back. It is a wicked dilemma, but one I think which, as you know, I believe we still need to stay the course with, because the alternative is to do the Singapore trick, which is to loosen too soon and then face a second wave. And that second wave could be very significantly longer and deeper than the first wave. And that would actually erode even more confidence in the economy and create a series of cascading failures that would probably flow into next year. But it is a wicked problem, and there are no simple answers. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.